it's actually Miller High Life. It's a champagne of beers.
High Life, nice. Is it a 32? Is it one of those big ones?
No, I have the remnants of a six pack in my fridge, so this is my third one.
Nice. So part two of the six pack, then. I get you. So yeah, I agree. Wally is kind of its own thing, and I haven't seen it in a while. I'd probably want to return to it before discussing that any further. Really,
really the perfect movie. I would love to talk about it with you after you watch it again. It's really good.
You got these last couple questions about robots and philosophy. Did you want to get into that stuff, or did you still want to talk more about the sort of integrated control issues?
I have a lot to say about technology. We can talk about that more. One way of talking about it is with the Matrix movies. I don't know if you want to, if you've covered the sequels to the Matrix movie.
I actually have not revisited those sequels since I first saw them. I didn't even see the third one at the theater. I was sort of so bland about the second one. I recently saw the first one, and I still sort of hold the opinion that the first one is a standalone, pretty good movie.
The first one's an excellent movie. I mean, it's hard to talk about it because it's one of those game-changing movies. It's the same way that you can't talk about Star Wars in any objective sense.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And I just feel like there's fun stuff going on in the second one, and not so much in the third one. And then the third one, kind of like you said, the big complaint there is that so much of it is in the quote real world with the attack on Zion, and it really just turns into a bunch of CG insects and laser fights and stuff.
So
they bit off a lot that they could chew with the whole Ergo guy constantly inane yammering and philosophy 101 speak.
Right. I watched the sequels in the theaters, and both times I didn't like them at all. And then years later, I went back to them and I watched them, and they're really not bad. I really like the way that they deal with technology also. But I think people just aren't interested in having a sophisticated discussion about technology. So I think just
the context of a Matrix movie isn't really where people would be interested in that to a degree. I mean, the first one does a little bit of that, but I mean, it's really more a discussion about you know, the whole perception is reality and you know, basic oppression of one group by another group.
Right. Well, all you really see of that is Agent Smith's humans are like a virus. But in that instance, Agent Smith isn't working for the Matrix, right? He had taken out his earpiece because he'd already been corrupted by that point, right? And that's part of what goes on in the second two movies.
So that's probably the only really interesting angle in terms of, for me, in terms of like the thematic stuff that's going on in those second movies, is the whole interaction between Smith and the Neo character.
Right.
The stuff with the Keymaster and all that, it started just getting very out there. And I could revisit it and see if it equates to anything, but it seems like to me they were struggling as writers to try to come up with a way to wrap this whole crazy world up in a nice little bow.
So they forced
it to me.
So I disagree with that. I think the struggle there was trying to, I mean, because it was really a hacker movie, right? They had to hack the Matrix. They were hacking the Gibson. They were hacking the Matrix. That's not very interesting. People are interested in the Agent Smith story, but right where they fight Dragon Ball Z style and like in the sky.
I just mean the stuff from the first one about him being corrupted by being in the human world, him being very much so like a gritty noir cop almost. It's just like, I am sick of this world.
Right.
I'm sick of these, you scummy people being this way. You are such, and the way he's so condescending and everything, he's, to me, he's almost one of the more interesting characters. And so when they bring him back in the second one, I'm interested in what they might do with him. And it seems like you said, they do kind of ultimately in the third one. That's why I felt so deflated by it, is it really just becomes this giant water drop fight sequence and stuff, which is kind of fun to look at, but like you said, they don't really go anywhere with it, and I feel like that was an unfortunate thing.
Well, I mean, the thing is that the Agent Smith is just the Frankenstein Frankenstein's monster character, right? It's just the machine that goes haywire.
Exactly. They just did that again, right. And to me, I was like, "That well, really, okay, that's kind of boring. They could have done
and,
some more."
Right, and part of it is that the technology used for the special effects hadn't jumped by leaps and bounds by the time they were making those movies, right? They did a lot of it in sort of pure CGI stuff, but it wasn't really that great, and it was sort of it looked like a video game, and so the action sequences weren't where the heart of the movie lies. The heart of the movie lies in the discussion of technology, which is the people's relationship to the Matrix itself. Or not to the Matrix, but to the whatever is the machine world, right? City Zero or whatever.
Yeah. Zion.
Well, Zion is the last human city, and then there's the main machine city.
You mean the world within the Matrix, the actual city?
No, not the world within the Matrix. Where the machines live, the city that Neo goes to at the very end to talk to the big.
Oh, okay. That's like the actual exactly 01 or whatever. Yeah, the Animatrix.
So there's the machine city, and the second two movies are about the relationship between the machine city and the human city. And I think this is where the movies are interesting, and I think this was just sort of lost in the general public, and so nobody really likes these two movies. But I like it in the same way that I like AI, the Haley Joel Osment film.
Yeah.
Right? It's not a very good movie, but they deal with technology very well. AI deals with robotics very well. The whole point of that movie is to make a non-human character sympathetic.
It's like you said, it's like a less interesting version of WALL-E. It's a little darker, and it's not quite as well thought out, maybe. But
right, like, but it also has this very cynical view of human nature and all this kind of stuff. So let's talk about robotics just a little bit. We'll talk about those movies later, but as far as the Terminator movies go, with robotics, so the point of making these Terminators is that they infiltrate human. Settlements, right? The resistance movement. And there's one scene in the very first movie where the Terminator gets beyond the barricades of the human city because it's all dressed like a human. And once it gets in there, as soon as it gets past the front gates, it pulls out its giant machine gun or laser gun or whatever and starts firing away and kills a bunch of orphans or something.
Yep.
Right? Which seems kind of silly because the Terminators are very sophisticated machines, and it doesn't seem like you need to be all that sophisticated to get beyond the door. If all you're going to do is just start blowing stuff up anyway, it seems like there's better weapons to do that. But anyway, for the conceit of the film, they send the Terminator back, and he has to kill Sarah Connor while passing for at least as well as possible a human being. Right. Part of the conceit of the film is that it's Arnold Schwarzenegger. Arnold Schwarzenegger doesn't pass for a human being very well anyway, and so he works perfectly for this role of a Terminator that's supposed to. Kind of pass for a human being. So this is one of the fundamental questions of artificial intelligence is when can a machine pass for being a human?
Yes.
This is what the Turing test is, right? The Turing test is the test for indistinguishability.
The Voight comp from another one of those boring 80s action movies, Blade Runner, right?
Right. right. So in Blade Runner, they're very, very sophisticated, right? And you have to do all these sophisticated eye tests in order to figure out.
And these questions that are very bizarre, and they're almost like they're very psychological. You see a turtle on its back. Do you help it? And humans might answer that question, quote unquote, wrong. It's. I always felt like that test was very. It was really interesting. Very weird.
Right. Right. Well. I mean, the conceit is, and this is part of artificial intelligence as a scientific study. Also, is it should be hard, right? It's a very sophisticated process for us as human beings to be able to recognize other conspecifics, other members of our own species.
Biology still has a tough crack at being able to properly define life. So yeah.
Well, it's not about defining life.
I'm just drawing an analogy to, like you said, you're trying to determine whether something is human versus artificial intelligence.
Right. So the question isn't can we make a definition of what counts as a human being, but the question is what does it take to pass for a human being? What does it take to fool us that you're human? Right. You and I have talked about the uncanny valley.
Well, and then the real question after that, I would almost think would have to do with how do you know that at that point how would you know that you've been fooled? I guess.
Well,
if you do pass for it, then by all whatever this standard you're setting is then are you not it? And if there's some way to know you're not, then you can't pass for it. You know what I mean? It's kind of a weird paradox.
Right, right. So the question is, what are we passing for, right? If we're just passing for intelligence, then the idea is you don't need to be human to be intelligent. Maybe a computer can be intelligent.
Absolutely not,
Maybe a computer can be intelligent, but if the computer's intelligent, that doesn't make it human. It just makes it an intelligent computer, right? And the idea of the Terminator is that the Terminator is intelligent in just the sense that it can solve problems, right? It understands how to drive a car, for instance, right? It can get behind a bunch of different cars and drive them. They're all going to be a little bit different, right? And how you handle a big truck is going to be different than how you handle, right? This is one of the things the Matrix movie did really well, is that, you know, they have to download the instructions to fly a helicopter. You can't just jump in a helicopter and fly it. You have to know how to right? And the Terminator knows how to do all these things, right? The Terminator also knows how to use a phone book to look up people, right? Part of the conceit of the film is that the Terminator doesn't have any specific files on where Sarah Connor is. So he just has to go to the town that he thinks she's in and find her. And he has to use the phone book to do that, right? And it looks like these are all intelligent processes, right? That doesn't mean the Terminator is human, but it means the Terminator can pass for intelligence. The Terminator can ask questions that make sense, give them context, and it can respond to questions, all this kind of stuff, right?
The real question there, I mean, you know, it is the 80s, and you had all those crazy punkers running around. I mean, you look at when he first arrives, he runs into Bill Paxton, who's like Laundry Day Wright, of course, and those guys are pretty weird, strange-looking guys. They pass for human. They're human, I guess. I mean, you know, you walk into any bookstore and hang out long enough in the, like, you know, Japanese manga section, and you're going to run into a pretty strange fellow that you're going to hope isn't even human, probably. So, I don't know what you mean. It, sky's the limit when it comes to the definition of what is human. But like you said, it's not about that. It's about whether or not you can trick people into believing, well, yeah, that's a person. And I think a lot of that is very superficial. Like you said, if you wrapped them in skin and made them anthropomorphic, you know, a bipedal organism with two eyes and a nose and a mouth, or maybe not even that.
Right.
People are going to take it at face value, literally.
right. So, so the Terminator can pass for humans. So it does things that humans do. So here's an interesting question about the Terminator. He uses the phone book. When the Terminator uses the phone book, the Terminator also uses its finger to sort of trace down the page of the phone book and find Sarah Connor. Right. So there's two shots in the first movie of people using the phone book. One is Kyle Reese using the phone book, and Kyle Reese uses his finger to sort of trace down to locate the Sarah Connor listing, and then traces it over to look at her address or her phone number or whatever. And then the Terminator goes to a phone book also and does the exact same thing. Uses his finger to find the Sarah Connor listings. Why does the Terminator use its finger? Presumably, you wouldn't need to use your finger, right? If the Terminator has good vision or whatever, right? If it can read, then it should just be able to look at the page and locate the Sarah Connor entry and not use its finger. Humans can do that too, right? You don't always have to use your finger when you're reading something.
That's true, but in the same way that humans do use their finger because their eyes can track in a certain way, if this Terminator is designed to, you know, based on, you know, detailed human anatomy and behavioralism charts or data or whatever, then it makes sense that they would design it to operate in a similar fashion, where, you know, to track things eyes, and then use things to assist it in that fashion.
Right, right. So
I don't know when he's using guns ever in the first or the second one. Does he draw a bead on something? Does he
ever
do that?
You mean sort of line it up in his sights?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know that a lot of times they just sort of default to cutting to the red vision and you know, he's targeting that way.
Right. I don't think he ever does it with
what he does. He does in the famous Hasta La Vista baby scene, right? Because he does hold the gun in a certain fashion, and I think he does make sure that he's got it in his sights. Huh. Like.
Yeah.
So right, yeah. Right.
So part of the lesson here is, well, it's twofold. One of them is that for human beings to read, sometimes we need to use our fingers, right? And this is sort of strange, you might think, from a certain view of human intelligence, that our finger has anything to do with it. Right? You might think, well, it's our mind doing it, or it's our brain doing the reading, and so really what matters is what's going on in the brain. So why would it matter what's going on at the tip of your finger? But as a matter of fact, look, our finger does help us track. It helps us orient our eyes, and orienting our eyes is an important part of being able to read. But it's a part that's not captured in what your brain does or what your mind does, right? It's part of it's captured in what your body does, what your eyes do, and what your finger does, right? And the Terminator also uses these heuristics, these sort of little helping devices to help it cognize the world. I mean, you might think that the fact that the Terminator used its finger was just a cinematic technique to get us to focus in on what the Terminator is focusing in on, right? It might just be part of the movie magic and not any deep point about Terminator's thinking.
Well,
but that's not
movie magic. You're basically, it sounds like you're just sort of writing it off as a potential one. Maybe they just didn't think about that.
Yeah,
now, I'm going to say Cameron is enough of a guy. Now, maybe like you said, this is damn near, I think he did Piranha 2 or something. I'm inclined to think that he thought about this sort of stuff and that he would have, especially because you have the parallelism between Reese doing it and the Terminator doing it also. So I'm inclined to think that's a purposeful thing.
Right.
That's a bit of direction that he would have had to decide to give Arnold.
Right. I mean, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But I'm just going to give him the benefit of the doubt for the purposes of the discussion and assume that he did.
Absolutely. That makes sense.
So what does this tell us? This tells us that part of what it is to think about the world is the sort of proper use of the environment to help you along. And the Terminator does this, you might think, in much the same way that human beings do this. Now, earlier you talked about nature versus nurture, right? And part of the idea here is that part of what gets us to march in sort of lockstep with our social environment, other people, other social institutions, and so on, is learning how to do that. That stuff's not programmed in our DNA. It's something that we learn through education, through being raised at mother's knee, right? This is part of the learning process. This is part of what organisms do. And the machines do this also. They do this also by a reliance on their environment. Right. So both us and...
Well, it's sensory input. And no matter how you want to put it, you've got a human being and you've got a machine, and they're both these... given organisms that need to respond to their environment based on the input that they're getting, they're outputting based on their input.
Well, it's not just sensory input, because it's also that they're built in such a way to handle that input in the right sort of way to learn from it, right? Not everything is built in the right sort of way to learn from, but we're building our machines precisely so that they learn from our social interactions with them. From sharing an environment with us, right? And so this is why I think that this view of machines as autonomous, that the Frankenstein's monster paradigm in talking about technology, talking about robotics, talking about robots in movies, is misguided, because it precisely overlooks this shared aspect to our existence, the existence that we share with machines. We share an environment and we share a social context when they're designed to interact with that social context. But all our machines...
Well, social... What do you mean by social context? I understand the idea that if you have a robot and you have a person and they're both standing at the edge of an ocean, at the beach, and then the tide draws in and then a tsunami comes, they're both, it rains on the human and the robot alike. But what is this social context that you're discussing? What does that mean? You're talking about you have a robot and you have a person, and they're both at like a cocktail party, and they both sort of know maybe how to properly behave to the hostess or something.
Right. And we build robots to do this, right? So Asmo, Honda's little Asmo. I'm sure you've seen video or pictures of this, right? Asmo has a sense of social distance, right? So there's two of these set up at the Honda headquarters. If you go to the headquarters and you walk into the lobby, they'll like take your coat or something. They serve you coffee and stuff.
But they keep to a proper distance. Now, what is that distance? Because human being, it's almost 30 years old. I have a sense of that. I have a sense that like people don't like people looking over them, their shoulders.
Right, close talker.
Yeah, exactly. But I have never really got a good sense of like what that, if you're on a bus and you're crammed together, but I guess, in it's seats on an airplane. There's a little bit of distance, but really not that much.
Right. There's no hard and fast rules.
No, there aren't.
But what there are a sort of shared social assumptions that we have about.
But my question is, for this robot, when they had to program it to have a sense for that, did they program it with a hard and fast rule of you stay 25 centimeters away from a person?
Well, what do you mean by hard and fast? It's probably
that's a quantifiable bit of data.
It's
going
to be stay away from them at this certain distance, unless you're serving them coffee, in which case you're probably going to need to get closer so they can grab.
Well, yeah, that part all goes without saying.
So there's
going to
be exceptions and judgment calls and this kind of thing. I mean, part of what these robots do is judgment calls, right? The robot's ability to walk upstairs is a judgment call on how it maintains its balance when it can start.
Something that Ed 209 was greatly lacking.
Right. And so you have a tension, right? So you have a tension when you're talking about sort of pure technology, which is just machines, and intelligent technology, which is usually robots, because the robots are making decisions. They're calculating in an important way, right? They're making judgment calls, and these judgment calls matter to us. And these are judgment calls that we don't think machines generally make, right? So the nuclear bomb in Dr. Strangelove isn't where the judgment. So this is another classic movie about technology, right? Where you're worried that the machine is out of our control, and part of the conceit of that movie is that there's a bunch of bumbling politicians and bureaucrats and warmongers pretending like they have control, and the bomb gets dropped anyway. But there it's just a bomb, right? The bomb has no intelligence; it's not making any decisions at all, right? It doesn't have any judgment calls to make. With robots, the problem is precisely that. Look, they're making decisions. They're intelligent. They can solve problems. And sometimes their solving problems can work with us, and sometimes it can work against us.
And that's the epitome of the whole issue with HAL 9000 in 2001. It's the stress of the judgment call. It's given information that it's told to withhold from the astronauts that are on board, and basically it's told. As a you know, to lie. I mean, that's what they reveal in 2010.
Right.
You know, the character that plays the guy that was the programmer of HAL basically says, well, the reason he was all screwed up is because they told him to tell a lie, and he didn't. You know, up was down and down was up, and he, you know, became legally insane, if you will, I guess. So that to me is why that's an interesting. That's an interesting angle on artificial intelligence, the idea of the stress that comes from that judgment call. Just like that's really all the drama in any story for humans, too. You know, you have the protagonist and the antagonist, and they're defined as a good or evil, like you said here, which is, you know, one of your next questions, based on not even so much the actions they take as the results of those actions, which are part of thinking about consequences, which are part of making the judgment to take that action in the first place. You know, it's neuroses.
Right. And this is part of exactly what it means to be autonomous, right? Is that it's doing things that we don't have control over, right? In order for it to make a judgment call in the first place, it has to be doing things that we didn't just program into it, but it's doing of its own accord.